Coming back again to the, now we're going to come back to the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thought. We have been going through the various defilements to be overcome, and then the kind of resultant from that, which is the jhana experiences and all of that, and eventually the awakening experience itself. And that is a lot of the suttas we have been looking at recently, last couple of days, have been about the problems or obstacles on the path. And now we can sort of come back to the two kinds of thought, because once the obstacles are removed, what remains in the mind are the good qualities of the mind, the good thoughts, the positive things. And yet even those good thoughts can occasionally become an obstacle if you want to go further. So now we're going to look in more depth at what happens once the negative obstacles are gone and what you have to do from that. So it's going to be building on, but also similar to what we have been seeing so far. So Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, two kinds of thought. And if you think back to what we were doing before, it is about this idea of dividing the world or dividing your mind into two categories, the unwholesome thoughts on the one hand and the wholesome ones on the other one, the skillful and the unskillful, if you like. And we looked at how to overcome the unskillful, and now we're going to look at the skillful thoughts and what to do with those, if anything, here. So the Buddha goes on, carrying on from where we were before. Then, as I was dwelling or being or staying or remaining, I don't think meditating to me is not quite right here, because this is like all-encompassing. It's like every kind of thing that you might do, you're going to have thoughts that are negative or positive, not just about meditation practice, but equally important, perhaps more important even outside of meditation, that you have to purify yourself almost continuously here. So as I remained, heedful, keen, and diligent, these three very important words again, heedful, keen, and diligent. And just to remind you that the heedful here is appamada, and this is a word that means using wisdom, reflecting on your experience, asking yourself whether this is useful or not, being careful about what you're doing here. And this is such an important part. You see this wisdom faculty coming up again and again on the Buddha's path. It is always such a fundamental part of what we're doing, trying to understand what is happening, trying to overcome the negative things. All of this revolves around the idea of wisdom, being smart about what you're doing here. So the idea of heedfulness is absolutely fundamental to the whole practice. But then there's this idea of being keen, the word atapi here. And this is like this interest that you have in the practice. Atapi is found in the Satipatthana Sutta. When you practice the meditation, you are, according to the Satipatthana Sutta, you are sampajana, atapi sampajano, and sattima. Sampajano is clear awareness, sampajanya, the clear awareness or the situational awareness. Sattima is just sati, mindfulness. And then you have atapi, which is this energy that you bring to it. And that energy is a mixture of effort that you put in. There's often a little bit of effort involved. You have to sit down and etc. But it's also the natural energy of the mind. And that natural energy of the mind manifests as a kind of keenness. You're interested. You're energized. You're inspired. All of these words kind of come together. And this is this idea here, is that you understand the significance of this. And because you understand the significance, and of course that understanding will vary a little bit. Some days you feel very uninspired, you don't see the significance of anything. Other days you kind of feel really inspired and you see a lot of significance. So that this will vary a lot. But when you really do see the significance, the energy comes out and the keenness arises. So you're keen and you're using wisdom, right? Going together, the energy is there, the inspiration is there. And then the last one, pahitatta, which is related to right effort, is the being diligent, being kind of sticking with things, not giving up easily, but carrying on, being persistent, persevering in the task. And that is when you have success, when you persevere over long periods of time, never really giving up. A bit like the Buddha himself, going through all the, making a lot of wrong turns. Sometimes you have to go through a few wrong turns. That's part of the dukkha of the practice. Go through a few wrong turns and to come back again, like the Buddha doing all of these self-tormenting, but then coming back again. So as you are remaining in this way and practicing accordingly, a thought of renunciation arose. A thought of renunciation. What does that even mean, a thought of renunciation? What are we renouncing? And the first of all, of course, what we are renouncing is the five sense world. And we're not renouncing it. It sounds like something negative, giving up something which is nice. But of course, you're not really renouncing anything at all. What you are, you're giving up something lower to gain something higher. So sometimes you wonder whether these words are good translations or not. Do they really give the flavor of what is going on? And sometimes it's a bit unclear. So if you're giving something up and achieving something higher, it is not as if you are denying yourself anything at all. If anything, you are looking for something better. So what does a thought of renunciation mean? Well, it just means a thought that inclines away from the five sense world, a thought where you understand the downsides of that, a thought that inspires you to meditate, the idea, I'd like to sit down and do some meditation and be peaceful, that kind of thought. The thought where you are fantasizing about meditation, right? Usually what happens in life is that we sit down in meditation and we fantasize about the five sense world. That's kind of usually what happens. Oh, I wish I could have some dinner at this retreat. All they give you, I don't know what they give you in the evening, but I'll get a bit of chocolate maybe or whatever. I wish I had some real kind of food in the evening. And you fantasize about the five sense world. This is the usual thing, but ideally what our life should be like, when we go around our five sense world, we go to work, we do our ordinary things, we should fantasize about meditation. Oh, I wish I could meditate. Oh, all this dukkha in this five sense world. Wow, I want to sit down. That is kind of the ideal. For someone who is a really good meditator, they might actually do that. Really want to just sit down and be peaceful because they know what it means. But for a lot of people, it doesn't really quite work like that. We get it the wrong way around. So this is the idea of thoughts of renunciation. The intention to renounce, the leaning of the mind in that direction. And you can see that leaning of the mind. You can see what happens in your mind when you sit down on a retreat like this. You can understand what is the inclination of your mind very clearly. After the first few days, when kind of the superficial problems of the mind, they start to die away, the superficial restlessness and tiredness, and the kind of worldly affairs, that start to you start to see them in the rearview mirror and they're kind of disappearing behind you, then what remains for the rest of your retreat is your inclination of the mind that you have. And you will see whether your mind tends to incline towards peace or whether it intends to worldly things. What happens in your mind during your retreat? Sometimes a little bit of a mixed bag, but this gives you an idea whether you're heading towards renunciation or heading towards more the sensory world. And that gives you an idea also of where you are likely to get reborn. Because the rebirth process happens through this inclination of the mind. Where does the mind lean when you are, going through the dying process? It gives an idea of what's going to happen in the future as well. And this is kind of interesting. This is one of the things you see in when you talk about dependent origination and the establishing of the mind in the future or the rebirth and the consciousness. It is all about where the mind inclines. What is the leaning of the mind? And you can have some idea of that right here. It's not about what you think you want, because what we think we want is one thing, but what we actually want is what you see when you kind of allow the mind to kind of run on empty, so to speak, and we can see where it is leaning. What is its inclination? So these are the thoughts of renunciation. You have some idea what's happening within you. And our job is to incline the mind more in that direction. So that's why, first of all, we give up the negative thoughts, and then we develop these positive thoughts. And then the mind starts to incline more towards these things. So the thought of renunciation arose. I understood this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. It does not lead to hurting myself, to hurting others, or hurting both. It nourishes wisdom. It is on the side of freedom from anguish, and it leads to extinguishment. If I were to keep on thinking and considering this all night, all day, all night and day, I see no danger that would come from that. So there is no danger in these positive thoughts. They're actually leaning in the right direction. You're not making any bad karma. You're not kind of dragging yourself down. In fact, you're lifting yourself up. These things are good karma that lead to more of the good things in the future. So it does not lead to hurting yourself. In fact, you can argue it leads to that freedom from hurting yourself in the long run. It doesn't hurt others. It doesn't hurt both. It nourishes wisdom. And that's kind of beautiful. Panya buddhika. Buddha means to increase, to nourish. So it increases wisdom, these kind of thoughts. And why is that? Well, the reason is because there is none of that bias in these thoughts. Whenever you think about things in the sensory realm or you're angry about things, there is a bias in the mind. You not see things as they actually are. But when you renounce that world, when there is no interest, there is no bias in that world, the mind doesn't lean towards any of these things. And when the mind is free of leaning towards things in this way, it just wants to give things up, then you see things clearly, and you can know things as they are. That's why it increases wisdom. And it is on the side of freedom from anguish. And it leads to extinguishment. Leads to nibbana is the word here. Why? Because it extinguishes all of the things that are opposite to renunciation. They are hot and they are lead to all kind of movement of the mind, the anti-extinguishment. So even if you keep on thinking like this all day and night, there is no danger coming from these things, from the thoughts of renunciation. Still, thinking and considering for too long would tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind is stressed. And when the mind is stressed, it is far from stillness. So I stilled, settled, and unified, and immersed my mind internally. Why is that? So that my mind would not be stressed. So any kind of thoughts leads to the tiredness of the mind and the body. And so you want to avoid all thoughts down the track. And here we want to avoid the good thoughts. Now, what you will notice here, when a very important part of the teaching here is the idea that the giving up of thoughts happen according to a certain sequence. So first of all, we give up the bad thoughts. Prior to giving up the bad thoughts, you give up the bad conduct by body and speech. First of all, the ordinary morality, then the deeper morality of the mind. And then, only then, does the coming up of the giving up of the good thoughts. It's kind of the final thing that we give up. And that sequence is critically important to understand that. Because what you often see in meditational circles is that people have not done their homework. They haven't done the foundations. They haven't built the foundations of the building. They try to build the superstructure without foundation. And that is a bad idea. You cannot build a house in thin air. You need the concrete foundation first of all. And so please build the foundations first. Then you can build the first story, the second story, etc., going up. You can't do that without a proper foundation. And so you need to get things in the right order. And sometimes people come on a retreat and they have all kinds of problems in their life. They haven't really given up anything at all. And then they start to still the mind completely from the get-go. Stilling everything completely without having followed this particular process of purifying. And of course, it's not going to work because the defilements are too strong and you cannot still the mind that is just so out of control. So getting the sequence right is very important here. And this is one of the things you find in the sutta, is the sequence of things, doing things in the right order. And sometimes that means, you know, you sit down, you look at your mind, and sometimes you may recognize, actually right now, maybe not such a good idea to meditate, right? My mind is a bit out of control. Let me do something else first, get those defilements out of the way, and then maybe you can sit down and you can meditate because your mind is more in the right state. You're able to do it. If you are really upset about something or you have some strong desires, you feel very restless, maybe not the right time to meditate, yeah? Then just do something. Have a cup of tea. Walk around a little bit. If you're at home, listen to something else. Read something. Do something which stabilizes the mind. Then you sit down. The purpose of meditation is not to suppress the unwholesome thoughts. It is to make the mind peaceful naturally. You have this interesting idea here. Thinking and pondering for too long would tire the body. And the word for body here is a kaya. And it is a bit unfortunate that it is translated with body. I can understand why. But it doesn't really mean body in the ordinary sense. Usually when we talk about body, we mean the physical body. But this is not really what this refers to. This refers more to the mental body. Yeah, and the mental body here is like the personality. The person, it tires the person. And in the suttas, we find this distinction on the one hand between the person, in other words, the individuality, what makes you who you are, and then consciousness. Consciousness is just awareness. Consciousness doesn't have any personal characteristics as such, because it's just the ability to be aware of things. The personal characteristics comes in your perceptions, who you take yourself to be, what you feel like, the kind of inclinations of your mind, the feelings you have about the world, your physical appearance, all of that is your personality. But awareness, consciousness kind of stands a little bit outside of that. It doesn't have any characteristics as such of personal differentiation, if you wish. So this is what kaya means here. Yeah? It means that your person is tired. Your kind of mental body is tired. And that includes the physical body, because the physical body is really just an extension of the mind in Buddhist theory. So you become tired, yeah, because of thinking too much, you feel that tiredness, and that affects your mind. Mind here, citta, is then similar to consciousness, yeah? There is kind of the personality and the mind are kind of intertwined in the kind of in this way. So this is a way of talking which is not, there isn't any clear distinctions here between mind and body, and that is what is to be expected, because in real life there is no clear distinction between these things. So the mind gets stressed, yeah? And when the mind is stressed or tired or whatever, it is far from stillness. Yeah? The mind needs to relax. The mind needs to be at ease. Then you can gain some samadhi. And that is why when you sit down, you can use this beautiful simile of the sitting in the armchair, just relaxing, allowing the world to be, allowing the energy to come back into your mind, because when you relax, when you don't do anything, the energy comes back again. And so this is actually not a bad idea of thinking about things, yeah? And some of the best meditators I know, they do exactly that. They just start off by leaning back against the wall, doing nothing, allowing the mind to rest. And when you just allow the mind to rest, the energy returns, and then the meditation happens as a consequence. And if you nod a little bit at the beginning of meditation, that's perfectly okay. Even the meditation teacher over here is also nodding a little bit. He's nodding all the time, isn't he? He's a bit, I don't know, I'm not sure about this one. But... So it's nice to have this tummy, kind of, you're just leaning on your tummy like that. Okay, anyway. So, so then you allow the energy to re-arise, and your energy comes back, and then, because of that, then you still, settle, unify, and immerse the mind eternally. And this is all about jhana states again. Yeah, the jhanas arise from this non-thinking, not kind of using your mind all the time. Why is that? So that my mind will not become stressed. So you stop the stressing of the mind. So this is the idea here, yeah, to allow the mind to become completely peaceful. And the more peaceful the mind is, the more still it is, the more power it has, the more energy it has. The energy arises in proportion to the stillness that you have. Then, as I meditated, heedful, keen, and diligent, a thought of goodwill arose in me. I understood this thought of goodwill has arisen in me. It doesn't lead to hurting myself, to hurting others, or hurting both. It nourishes wisdom. It's on the side of freedom from anguish, and it leads to extinguishment. If I were to keep on thinking and considering this all night, all day, all night and day, I see no danger that would come from that. Still thinking and considering for too long would tire my person. And when the person is tired, the mind is stressed. And when the mind is stressed, it is far from stillness. So I still settled and unified and immersed my mind eternally. Why is that? So that my mind would not be stressed. Goodwill here is opposite of Vyapada, which is ill will, so non-ill will. You can call it metta if you like, or call it goodwill or loving kindness, all these various translations of this term. And so you have goodwill towards others. You think kind thoughts. This kind thoughts, and it's kind of nice, kind thoughts nourishes wisdom. They nourish wisdom because you don't have that biased view of others, which is negative. You just have a sense of compassion and wisdom. Then exactly the same thing, even those thoughts that are so beneficial in so many ways, you don't want to have too many of them. So then you still the mind in exactly the same way. And then you have the thoughts of harmlessness. And thoughts of harmlessness, these are thoughts of compassion. Compassion is the opposite. Compassion is the wanting to alleviate the harm and suffering of others. So this, again, is our positive thoughts that nourish wisdom, but still you want to not have too many of them. You want to still the mind ultimately, and you want to bring it into the jhana state. So again, it is the same idea, overcoming the bad thoughts by using the good thoughts. There is a simile in the sutta I mentioned the other day, the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the calming of thoughts, and they have the simile of extracting a large peg using a small peg. So if there's a large peg in the wall or something and you want to extract it, you use a small peg to get it out. In the same way, you use the small, the beautiful, the nice thoughts to extract the kind of big bad thoughts. And you kind of get rid of the big bad thoughts using the kind thoughts instead. And this is kind of the idea here. So this is how this works. So what then? And then comes this idea again about kind of making a habit out of these things. Whatever a mendicant frequently thinks about and considers becomes their heart's inclination. If they often think about and consider thoughts of renunciation, they have given up sensual thoughts to cultivate the thought of renunciation. So the sensual thoughts here is the thoughts of the five sense realm. The mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation, and they often think about and consider, if they often think about and consider thoughts of goodwill, and then thoughts of harmlessness, the mind inclines towards thoughts of goodwill and thoughts of harmlessness. So the idea, this is kind of the beautiful thing about this, is as you practice the path, these things start to become second nature. The idea is always very hard in the beginning because you are still very attached to the five sense world. You're still attached to your favorite enemies. You have your enemies, those people you don't like. And after a while, you give up having favorite enemies. And then you only get favorite friends after a while. And at the worst, you have neutral people in your life. So you give up all of these pet hates. That's an English expression, isn't it? Pet hate. So we like to have our little hates. And then you shift your whole mind. This idea of the super tanker, the idea of something with enormous momentum, something with incredible weight, moving forward at high speed. Takes a long time to shift it around. But it can be done. You just have to be patient. Again and again and again, you remind yourself that this is not a useful way of looking at other people, and you bring up the alternative ways of thinking about others, the compassion, the understanding, seeing the good qualities. One of those ways, of which I haven't mentioned, about seeing the good qualities in others, this is also found in that sutta we mentioned the other day, the numerical discourses, the chapter of 5, number 162, the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, the overcoming of resentment or ill will sutta. And in that sutta there is a simile of the rag-robed monk. Yeah. And the simile of the rag-robed monk is the kind of a rag-robed monk is wandering around, and then when they see a rag by the roadside, the rag-robed monk is very happy. Yeah, rag. Just checking out if there are any rag-robed monks here, but no, there's no really real rag-robed monks at the moment. And my robe is brand new. There's not a single patch on this robe. But some of the monks in the monastery have really got really kind of rag-robed monks. And because you are a rag-robed monk, you find a rag, you are happy, because a rag robe needs to be repaired all the time. It tends to fall apart because the rags are not very solid. And so what do you do when you are a rag-robed monk and you find a rag by the roadside? Well, what you do is you spread out that rag, put your left foot on one side, you spread it out with the right foot, and you check out this rag. And you see, like, a part of the rag is useless, part of it is rotten, and it's beyond usage. So what do you do? Well, you tear the rag, you tear off the bad part, and you throw it out, because it's bad, it's useless. And then you take the rest of the rag, you fold it up nicely, and you carry it with you until you need it and require it for repairing whatever. That is what a rag-robed monk does. And it's exactly the same when we encounter people in our life. Yeah, when we see a person alive, and sometimes we have ill will even towards people we actually appreciate and respect. And then what we do is that we kind of look at the person, we kind of spread out the qualities of the person, yeah, the really good ones, the bad ones, and we see all the qualities in our mind's eye. And then somewhere down the middle, where the bad qualities begin, we tear off those bad qualities, we crunch it up, and we throw it out. Yeah, maybe you kind of flush it down the toilet because these are bad qualities. And you get rid of those bad qualities, and then you have the good qualities remaining, and you kind of fold them up, and you take it into your heart, and you carry them with you into the future, and you kind of shelve them in your mind. You have this little shelf, which has the person A, person B, and you have the qualities in that shelf. And when you then think about that person in the wrong way, you kind of go to that shelf and you bring out all those good qualities that you have shelved in your heart. Yeah, this is the idea. And then when you see those good qualities, you abandon the negative perception you have of that person, because you know that those good qualities, that is what really matters. It is like being part of a community like this and seeing people with good intentions who want to do the right thing. Well, that is what matters. Whether they make little mistakes or they kind of get it wrong sometimes, it's kind of irrelevant. Everyone gets it wrong. And who knows if they got it wrong anyway? Maybe it's just my perception. Who knows what's really going on? What matters is that the beautiful qualities. So what you need to do, especially if there's someone you're having a bit of trouble with, but you know deep down that they are a good person to be respected, you build up the good qualities. You look at them again and again, and you ensure that those are the prominent ideas and qualities of that person in your mind. And so when you need to think about them, you bring those things out. And if you have done it in a lot and built up this idea, positive idea of person very strongly, it evaporates the bad qualities just like that. They just disappear. You can't think about it anymore, because the good qualities overpower the perception of the negative qualities. That is the idea with this. And it is very nice, because I was talking before about how to use compassion. The idea of compassion is when someone is difficult, you can't see the good qualities in them, and they are treating you badly, then you have to use compassion usually. But before we use compassion, we should always try to have metta and kindness and goodwill instead. Goodwill is in many ways more important than compassion, because when you have goodwill, it always leads to a good feeling. It always comes something positive with that. You're seeing the world in a bright way. Compassion often is closely related to suffering in other people, and it can sometimes lead to a maybe heaviness of mind if you don't get it right. But seeing the good qualities in other will always be positive, always be uplifting, always be something that you will aid you on the path and aid you on the right track. So for this reason, it is very useful to see the good qualities, like the rag robe monk carrying the beautiful little rag with them. Maybe the rag robe nun. There's usually rag robe monks, maybe there were some rag robe nuns as well, I'm not sure about that. And so this is how you then do these things in the in a way that is positive. Yeah, seeing the good in other people, such an important part of this. And it is not that difficult. This is the interesting thing. You just need to apply the mind in the right way, and it can be done. Everyone can do this. It is not that hard. And once you start to see it work inside of you, it's kind of like magic. It's like you're becoming a new person. You're becoming a brighter version of yourself. And you wonder what happened to your old self. And you can see that you are changing. You're becoming this kind of little bit saintly person. Because you have all these good feelings inside of you, the good perception about others. You can see the shift happening. And that's kind of very encouraging when you see that. Part of the problem is sometimes that we feel like we are in a certain way. This is my character. And the sense of self will take that to be much more solid than it actually is. But of course, you're not really solid. Because you are the product of conditioning, you can recondition yourself. You can become a different person. You should never buy into this idea that you are what you are and nothing can be done with it. Lots can be done with it. It's only if you believe in some permanent essence that there may be a stop to what you can do. But if you are entirely malleable, entirely conditioned, the conditioning, there's no end to what you can do to yourself and change yourself. And it's a very amazing thing that happens on the Buddhist path when you see that change happening. Very encouraging. And then you take this practice further. So this is the idea of the seeing the good in others. Now, one of the kind of interesting points that I often talk about when I mention this particular thing here, this time I haven't included this sutta, maybe that was a mistake. I don't know what is a mistake and what is not. You just tell me randomly some suttas can make their way in, others don't. You're not really sure sometimes exactly how that happens, but it happens. And one of these ideas, one of the questions that can arise is, well, are we really seeing things in accordance with reality if we just see the good qualities in others? Surely other people have bad qualities as well, right? Are we being honest? Isn't Buddhism about seeing things in accordance with reality? Aren't we just deluding ourselves, pretending that people are better than they are? And the answer to that question, to that, complaint, if you like, that question is that we don't know what other people are like. We don't know how many good qualities they have or how many bad qualities they have. All we know is that we are biased in our outlook. Some people like that person, some people don't. Who they actually are is unknown. Not only is it unknown, but they are changing all the time. They may be moving from one kind of part of life to another part of life. And so it is a wrong question to ask, what is that person like? Because there is no answer to that question. When we talk about knowledge and understanding and wisdom in Buddhism, it does not refer to such things. It refers to very different things. It refers to seeing things as impermanent, seeing the non-self nature of things. It refers to more kind of universal characteristics about what is going on, not to specifics of personality. And so the answer, this is a wrong question to ask. What is the person like? The right question to ask is, what is helpful for my spiritual practice? That is the right question. And what is helpful for your spiritual practice is always to see the good in other people. See the positive. And if there is something negative there, you forgive that, because the positive is so much larger. That does not mean that you completely deny the negative. It doesn't mean that you close your eyes completely, but you forgive the negative, you focus on the positive. But if there is negative, something bad, you also have to be honest about that to some extent. Otherwise, you may be, people may abuse you or do bad things, or they may take advantage of you, whatever. So we can't completely deny the negative things, but we focus on the positive, and then we forgive the negative, and that combination together is very powerful, while remembering that human nature, human beings are fallible. Sometimes they will do things that are negative, and so we don't become foolish and naive and then just allow ourselves to be abused or used or whatever by others. That's also not right. So it's like a fine balance there, seeing the good while remembering the fallibility of human beings. And then the kind of things start to come out as things start to come right as a consequence. So this is how you do this. It's very powerful. And this, again, I would really recommend you to read that sutta. Maybe you read that sutta already. There's a nice story. I tell this on every retreat I teach, because it's kind of a nice story. And this is a story precisely about a rag robe wearing monk. Yeah, and this is found in the Vinaya Pitaka. You don't get to read these stories unless you know someone who reads the Vinaya. I read the Vinaya, so you hear it from me, not from many others. And this is the story, because rag robe wearing monks, because they are desperate for rags, they will go anywhere to find rags. And one of the favorite places to find a rag is the charnel ground, where they throw the corpses away, because for reasons of modesty, they will wrap the corpse in some cloth, right? And then they will kind of lie in the charnel ground. And then the monks, they will go to the charnel ground and they will kind of take the cloth off the corpses. This is like a real rag robe wearing monk. Yeah, take the cloth from the corpse. That's kind of cruel, isn't it? So the corpse uses it first, and then you use it afterwards. But you have to be careful when you take cloth from a corpse. So this one monk, he goes up to this corpse and he starts taking the cloth. And as he's kind of unrolling the cloth of the corpse starts to talk. And the corpse says, "Don't take my cloth." Yeah, the corpse is starting to feeling a bit naked. It doesn't kind of like the idea of being naked. So, "Don't take my cloth." And the monk says, "Shut up, you're dead. Yeah, you don't have a say in this." Actually, I'm just adding this to the story. It doesn't say that at all in the story. But that's kind of the undertone, the feeling you get, right? Okay, you are finished. You move on to your next destination and just allow me to take your cloth. And so he continues taking the cloth, right? Not listening to this corpse. And then when he gets all the cloth, yeah, he walks off. And then after he walks off, the corpse gets up, right? And he starts walking behind him. And it's like a zombie, right? This is kind of the original zombie move. I think the zombie move has got the kind of ideas from the Buddhist books, actually. I think that's probably the most likely thing. It's kind of fascinating how these things kind of recur in the history of humanity, isn't it? These days we have zombie movies, and those days they had the books on the Vinaya Pitaka, and it's all the same. It's all kind of similar kind of thing. It's kind of extraordinary. Some of the stories in there are really wild, and this is kind of one of them. And then the monk's kind of looking over his shoulder, seeing this corpse, getting a bit concerned. How would you feel if you had a corpse coming behind you? Would you feel concerned? Probably you would feel a bit concerned, right? And so he starts running, holding onto the cloth, right? Clutching the cloth, running and running towards his cutie. Slams the door shut, and then the corpse comes and falls down outside the cutie. And he goes, "Okay, I just made it. Yeah, the corpse didn't get me." And then eventually the corpse dies. Yeah, the zombie has kind of used up its remaining energy, and there's no energy left. So that's the story of the original zombie story in the world. I don't think there's any aspect, any kind of world literature that has an earlier occurrence of zombie. It happens in Buddhist literature, first of all. This is 2,500-year-old zombie story. Yeah. And then what happens? That's not the end of the story. And then they go to the Buddha and they tell the Buddha what happened. Yeah, this is what the Buddha has to deal with everything, right? This happened. Yeah, what should we do? And the Buddha has to kind of answer every conceivable question. And the Buddha, this monk, he is growing his nails a bit too long. You know, what should we do about that? And then the Buddha would lay down a rule about how long your nails can be, or about the color of your robes, or about personal hygiene. All these kind of tiny little things that the Buddha had to deal with. And you feel a bit sorry for the Buddha sometimes. That's why Parinibbana, when the Buddha dies, the Buddha is very happy. Everyone else is grieving, but the Buddha finally getting out of this mess, right? In the story, then they go to the Buddha and they tell him the story. And then the Buddha says, "Well, okay, from now on, if you're going to take a cloth from the corpse, make sure the corpse is cold before you take the cloth. If the corpse is warm, there's still a chance it will get up and follow you. So this is why the monks have so many rules. Because one of the rules is don't take cloth from a warm corpse. That's kind of one of the monastic rules. So this is what you kind of what you, if you ever want to become a monastic, this is the kind of thing you have to study here. So interesting. Anyway, it's a little bit of a side issue. It's not kind of a core part of this sutta, but it's nevertheless it's kind of interesting. So you your mind inclines towards all of these things, and after a while, because your mind inclines towards things, you build this up in the same way. You take the good qualities of the person with you, and you see the good qualities, and after a while you can't see the negative things anymore. Yeah, you always see the good things in others. You always talk about the good things in other people. Sometimes you can know how other people think, how their minds are inclining, by what comes out of their mouth. Yeah, if they talk a lot of negative things about others, you can be pretty sure that's what they think as well. But people who speak very beautifully about others, they tend to think good things about others as well. And so everything just falls into place when you think the right thing. And when people are bad, then you have compassion, and everything becomes in the right way. And then the path becomes kind of easy. Right? Because everything is already kind of put in place, and the path just works by itself. All right. Then comes the simile. Suppose it's the last month of summer when all the crops have been gathered within a village, and a cowherd must take care of the cattle. While at the root of a tree or in the open, he need only be mindful that the cattle are there. In the same way, I needed only to be mindful that those things, in other words, those mental qualities, were present. And so the cowherd can now chillax, sitting at the foot of a tree, and just be aware of the cows. And just because there are no crops around, the crops here are probably the five-sense world, and the five-sense world has been, there's no interest anymore, it's no longer there, and the cows are just grazing peacefully, and all he does is be mindful that those qualities are there. In the same way, we have to be mindful that those good qualities of the mind are present, and that's all you really have to do, and you don't have to tap the cows here, tap the cows there, because the mind is behaving in the right way. And then comes, when all of this happens, then you are ready to experience the deep states of meditation again. So my energy was roused up and unflagging. My mindfulness was established and lucid. My body was tranquil and undisturbed. And my mind was stilled in samadhi. We see this phrase before. You can see how these phrases, they recur in the suttas again and again in many places. It is an oral literature, and because it is oral, the phrases recur. But they are beautiful phrases, right? They are phrases that are very meaningful. And what you're seeing here, as I mentioned before, you're seeing really the awakening factors are right there. Four of the seven awakening factors are mentioned right there within that little phrase. So the awakening factors are building up at this particular point. Clear and established mindfulness. This is kind of awakening factor of mindfulness. The body really solid and undisturbed, doesn't want to move, doesn't want to do anything. The energy is strong, and it stays strong, unflagging. It stays strong for long periods of time. And this is the kind of mind, the mind that has these awakening factors, the one that is ready for everything, really, starting with the jhanas. So quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from the unwholesome qualities, I entered and remained in the first absorption, the first jhana. So then the sutta goes on to talk about the four jhanas. Then it goes on to talk about the awakening experiences, all the way to becoming an arahant. And then after all of that, then the sutta goes into this simile, a simile which talks about basically all that has happened before, to make the point. And it's a beautiful little simile, so I've included it here. And this is how it goes. Suppose that in a forested wilderness there was an an expanse of low-lying marshes, and a large herd of deer lived nearby. Then along comes a person who wants to harm, injure, and threaten them. They close off the safe, secure path that leads to happiness and open the wrong path. There they plant a domesticated male and female deer as decoys, so that in due course that herd of deer would fall to ruin and disaster. Then along comes a person who wants to help keep the herd of deer safe. They open up the safe, secure path that leads to happiness and close off the wrong path. They get rid of the decoys so that in due course that herd of deer would grow, increase, and mature. So that is a kind of a nice simile. So let's see how the Buddha explained this simile. I have made up this simile to make a point, and this is what it means. An expanse of low-lying marshes is a term for sensual pleasures. So remember that when we talk about sensual pleasures, what we really mean is the five-sense world. Yeah, it's a very broad thing. Again, this translation, sensual pleasures, it really misses a lot of what this is about, because it's a very, very expansive and all-encompassing thing that we are immersed in pretty much all our lives. And of course, it is very interesting the way it is explained here. Yeah, the point of simile is to give you a feeling for these things. And this is a beautiful kind of, arouses some very kind of powerful feelings about what this world is like. And first of all, it is a marsh, right? A marsh is like a swamp. It's like a place you get stuck, a place that is hard to get out of. And this, I spoke about this earlier on, but here it is, you find it again. So the sensual pleasures are sticky. It is difficult to see the downside because they seem superficially enjoyable, and you actually don't see the problem in them. That's why they're so hard to get out of. Overcoming anger is far easier. And so really, everyone should really focus on anger and ill will first of all. And then only secondary comes the overcoming of the five-sense realm. But because it is really difficult to overcome, because it appears so pleasant. So it's like a marsh. You get stuck. It's like treacle. Yeah, really hard to get out. But the second adjective here, which is used to explain this, it's a low-lying kind of marsh. It is not any kind of marsh. Yeah, it's not the marsh on the mountaintop. Actually, you don't normally find marshes on the mountaintops anyway. So it's a low-lying marsh. And of course, there is a reason why the Buddha uses these kind of words. Low-lying, because it is inferior. Yeah, it is low. It doesn't really give very much satisfaction and happiness in the world. It's an endless pursuit of something which is not really satisfying. And that's kind of the scary thing about this sensory world, this endless pursuit, always running after it, always thinking that somehow a satisfaction will come around the corner, and we never seem to learn. But the Buddha tells us then straight, he goes straight to the point, this is low-lying stuff, listen. Yeah? This is the wrong place to look for happiness and satisfaction and contentment. It cannot be found in this low-lying marsh. And elsewhere we saw the words like okara being used, okara meaning that which brings you low. Yeah, if you indulge too much in these things, it kind of brings you low, takes you down, and it kind of destroys a lot of that higher mind, the adicitta that you're trying to achieve. So it's a low-lying marsh. Not just is it low-lying marsh, it is an expansive marsh. Yeah, it goes on. It is kind of, there's always more indulgence. There's always varieties of the five sensual pleasures. Yeah, there's endless varieties. There's endless relationships we can have. There's endless enjoyment in traveling around the world, eating different foods, seeing different sceneries. This kind of, it goes on. And it's very easy to get caught up in that and think that somehow, ultimately, finally, you will find some real satisfaction in that realm. But actually, just more of the same. Variations on the theme. Nothing substantial. The same underlying problems are there for all of these sensory objects. So this is a bit like in the Second noble truth, you have the expression tatra tatra binandini. Tatra tatra binandini means, abinandini means to delight, and tatra tatra means like here and there. Yeah, in other words, always going around this enormous expanse. There's no end to it. So it's very useful to consider these kind of similes made by the Buddha, because it's very, this is much more tangible, right? One thing is to read the prose and the Buddha says, well, this is lesser happiness, this is more happiness. But this kind of drives the point home. It's easy to feel what is going on when you read this kind of explanation here. The large herd of deer is a term for sentient beings. Yeah, large herd. Again, I think the I'm not sure how meaningful the simile is here, but deer, yeah. Deer, again, are not very intelligent. They kind of follow their conditions and causes. And we are maybe more like deer than we would like to admit sometimes. Yeah, we are also the results of our conditioning, just like deer are the result of their conditioning. We are very similar to that. And sometimes we just move according to, you know, you hear a sound from the left, you get afraid, and you move to the right. Like a deer would be fearful of the sounds of human beings. And we are herd animals in many ways, like deer. We tend to follow the crowd, to move along. And we don't really think enough for ourselves. And so we get trapped very easily in these expansive low-lying marshes. Because everyone else is trapped there, we are also trapped there. We just follow what everyone else does. Your parents tell you when you're young, get, you know, work really hard at school, get good grades, yeah, and then find a nice girl or boy, get married, have kids, yeah, and then you will be satisfied. No, you won't be satisfied. Yeah, it's your parents. They don't know what they're talking about. How could they possibly know? They have gone into the trap already. They have made all the mistakes before you. Of course they're not going to know what's going on. So you have to be a bit rebellious. Yeah, you listen to your parents sometimes, but not always. Sometimes you say, okay, very, very good, mom and dad, but this is what I'm doing. And your parents will, you know, they will thank you down the track that you were rebellious, because they will realize eventually that you were right. And this is the beautiful thing about this. So you try to get out of that herd. And a person who wants to harm and injure and threaten them is a term for Mara, the wicked. Yeah, pop. Mara Papima. Papima is the wicked one. Yeah, so Mara is what is Mara exactly? The Mara is a lot of Mara is like the tempter within. Yeah, the human psychology. We are tempted by things. This is the term for the human psychology. And sometimes Mara is also considered like a external being that actually tries to tempt beings being stuck in samsara. But the most important idea of Mara is that it is a term for human psychology, whereby we always get tempted by things, yeah? And that temptation actually leads us to harm and injury, etc. The wrong path is the term for the wrong eightfold path. That is wrong view, wrong thought, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong samadhi. A domesticated male deer is a term for greed and relishing. Yeah. Yeah, desire is a term for the domesticated male deer. So the desire is there, and that is the decoy. And the domesticated female deer, which is the other decoy, is a term for ignorance. So you have these two things, craving and ignorance, desire and ignorance, avidya and tanha. And these two terms are two things that drive you on in samsaric existence. You are hindered by ignorance, yeah? You are in darkness because of ignorance, and you are fettered by craving and hindered by ignorance. Fettered is sanyojana. Sanyojana means that you are bound to things. And hindered here is nivarana. You are nivarana. You are hindered by avidya, which is the ignorance here. Ignorance makes you blind, whereas craving is the fetter that ties you to the round of existence and kind of moves you on from life to life. Yeah, it binds you to the world, projects you into the future, and you are bound. And this is a This occurs in a few places in the suttas, this kind of meaning, yeah, fettered by craving, yeah, hindered by ignorance. And so gradually what we do is that we try to reduce the ignorance. We try to see things more clearly. And as we do that, the fetter becomes looser. The fetter loses its strength. And eventually one day, the fetter is completely gone. A fetter is just another word for a bond or a tie. Yeah. A person who wants to help keep the herd of deer safe is a term for the Buddha, the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha. The safe, secure path that leads to happiness is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right stillness. So mendicants, I have opened up the safe, secure path to happiness and closed off the wrong path. I have got rid of the male and female decoys. Out of compassion, I have done what the teacher should do, who wants what is best for the disciples. Here are these roots of trees, and here are these empty huts. Practice absorption, mendicants. Don't be negligent. Don't regret it later. This is my instruction to you. And this is kind of the way that the Buddha often ends a sutta. Yeah, he gives a rousing sutta. And his beautiful similes at the end. And then he says that, I have done what should be done by a teacher out of compassion. I've done all that I can do. Now it is up to you to take these instructions seriously. And you will notice that what it means to take these instructions seriously is basically meditation practice, specifically absorption, the jhanas. Jayata bhikkhave. Jayata is like meditate, practice jhanas. And go to the roots of the trees and the empty huts, because that is where real, deep meditation happens. Don't be negligent. Don't regret it later. Now is the opportunity. This is my instruction to you. The Buddha is trying to rouse you, get you going, get you started, because now he has done his job. That is what the Buddha said. Satisfied, the mendicants were happy with what the Buddha said. All right, so that is the Majjhima Nikaya number 19, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the two kinds of thoughts. So now please find those roots of trees, find those empty rooms, yeah? Go and do some meditation and have a nice afternoon and evening, and we'll see you back again at 7 o'clock. Yeah?